And now we continue with part two of Atomic Bombers by Russell Vandenbroek. After Enrico Fermi and his team achieve the first chain reaction, Oppenheimer and General Groves begin to assemble the core members of the Manhattan Project team at a remote location in the high New Mexico desert, Los Alamos.
They gave me an orientation packet.
Orientation?
Goody, let's hear.
Answers to questions.
Let's start with housing.
What it says about housing?
Two and four family units.
Tenements.
Single rooms for bachelors and bachelorettes.
Bachelorettes.
Three, four, six-room apartments for families. Housing assigned on family size.
Heat.
Hot air.
Electricity.
Yes.
Furnishings.
Shelves, cots.
Cots.
Kitchen tables, chairs.
Electric refrigerator.
Rent.
Pro rata of salary.
Sounds like socialism.
Utilities.
Pro rata of salary.
More socialism. Meds.
For occasional help, depending on need.
Workers from nearby Spanish villages and Indian pueblos.
Laundry.
Public.
Small charge.
Pro rata.
Hospital.
Run by doctors.
Universal coverage.
Cost.
Free to everyone.
Ah, from socialism to communism.
Location?
P.O. Box 1663.
Sandoval County Road.
Santa Fe, New Mexico.
USA.
That's reassuring.
That's not reassuring.
When would we go?
Right away.
A year or so.
Why would we go?
Can't say.
What an adventure.
Oh, we've had enough adventure.
Like heading west in covered wagons.
To study intimate secrets of Mother Nature.
Living outside New York for a change.
I've lived in too many places to change.
No kids to hold us back.
Think about the kids.
Great for your career.
Bad for la familia.
Let's go, coach, right now.
Let's not, Enrico. Per favore, not yet.
Not quite yet.
Where would I stay?
Oh, Oppenheimer found a hospital in Albuquerque. J. Robert Oppenheimer. He's scientific director. Wonderful man who recruited me. And he's worried about your tuberculosis.
How far will I be from your magic mesa?
100 miles, but I will hitchhike down every weekend. Honest engine.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Okay, now, the labs aren't ready. I'm going out there to help. You can too, but remember this. It's very important. Don't buy your tickets at the local depot. It's a small station. There's such a big group from Princeton, it'll look suspicious.
One way to Chicago, please.
One way to Denver, please.
One way to St. Louis, please.
Chicago to Knoxville, Tennessee, please.
One way to Kansas City, please.
One way to Tulsa, please.
With everyone buying tickets for somewhere else, I figured it wouldn't be suspicious if I just went to the Princeton Depot and... 2 tickets to Albuquerque, please. One way.
Albuquerque?
Albuquerque.
New Mexico?
New Mexico.
So all these bags are yours?
Well, me and my family.
It's a big family.
Christmas presents.
In March.
My first time west of Chicago.
Mine too. Listen to this. The Los Alamos Ranch School is located in a region where the new world of Spaniards and American settlers meets the old of indigenous Indians. This region contains the largest extinct volcano in the entire world.
Extinct?
It says extinct. The Pajarito Plateau and Jemez Mountains were created by countless volcanic explosions, blasting the Earth's epicenter high into the prehistoric sky.
Blasting?
Such a tumultuous primordial past makes this an ideal place for geologists to unearth the secrets of nature. Nearby, anthropologists and archaeologists have the rare opportunity to unearth the secrets of nature, probe agrarian cultures, rain dances, and fertility rites.
Fertility?
It is our philosophy that the adolescent period is the crucial one in the life of a boy. If he has every opportunity to build up his health in the most safe and scientific manner, he is not likely to suffer breakdown later.
Safe?
There's more.
Scientific breakdown? You think they anticipated it?
Los Alamos is a place where boys become men.
A I'll be back this weekend.
I thought we could cook steaks.
What, the doctors let you leave the hospital?
I meant at it.
Surely you're joking, no. Mrs. Feynman. You expect me to cook steaks outside a hospital while everyone in downtown Albuquerque stares at me?
What do you care what other people think?
Time to go. Kiss?
Sure. On the cheek.
Right.
Someday there won't be bacteria in my lungs or mouth.
Welcome to Shangri-La, Dick.
Oh, hey, I thought we were supposed to call it Site Y, Bob.
Project Y, Zia Project, Happy Valley, The Hill. Take your pick.
Hey, you exaggerated, you old son of a gun. I see one new building.
Huh?
Which lab is it?
Oh, the movie house?
Movie house?
Yep, 12 cents. Hey, look, we're not hopelessly behind. A cyclotron's coming by boxcar from... Yeah. Two pressure Van de Graaffs from...
Wisconsin.
Yeah. And a Cockcroft Walton outfit.
Uh-huh.
From?
University of Illinois.
Right again. Hey, your dorm will remind you of college, too.
Dormitory?
Men only.
Surely you're joking, Mr. Wilson.
Roommate included. And you stay at a dude ranch until the dorm's built.
Oh, any dudettes?
Oppie's expecting us for an introductory conference.
Attention, friends. We've looked forward to this blessed day a long time. Before turning to the science, General Groves has a few words.
Men, we're all interdependent. That's why you must be ever vigilant about what you say and who you say it to. Just to help, the perimeter is going to be strung with barbed wire.
To keep strangers out or us in?
Both. Furthermore, your mail will be censored.
You can't censor civilians.
Which is why you'll have to agree to it. I also want to start using code. Physicists will be called fizzlers. What? Chemists
what?
Are stinkers.
What?
Top top means atom, and topic means anyone?
Atomic?
Whoa. Correct, correct.
Jeez.
Boat means bomb, and topic boat. Eh?
Atomic bomb.
Right again. An igloo of urchin is an isotope of uranium, and urchin fashion means...
Uranium fission.
That's right. You boys are sharp. Uranium-235 may be called magnesium or class tenure. No. Not because you're professors. 2 + 3 + 5 = 10, and your is the first syllable of uranium. Tenure.
Well, are we supposed to fool anyone?
Some of you get code names. Enrico Fermi?
Present.
You'll be Eugene Farmer. Arthur Compton?
He's in Chicago.
Wigner?
Yeah.
You're Wagner. Harold Urey?
Yes.
You're Harry Upton. Ernest Lawrence, you're Ernest Lawson.
Okay.
Who's the army going to fool using real initials, illiterates or the deaf and dumb?
Who are you?
Richard Feynman.
Richard Feynman, I can't... you're so important, Feynman, you're going to be called Dick. That's it for today, men. Now that I'm leaving, you can all start talking like fizzlers and stinkers.
All right. I want all of you to remember that our work, if successful, will end the war. Wasted hours mean wasted lives. The military wants information compartmentalized, but that slows progress, makes it less likely we'll get there first. We need to share our ideas, our theories, and most of all, our imaginations. Now, even so, neither wives nor parents can be told the true purpose of our work.
Which is what, exactly?
To produce a practical military weapon that releases energy in a fast neutron chain reaction. It should be small and light enough to be carried in an airplane. Now, since the energy release in TNT is 3.6 times 10 to the 16th ergs per ton, we calculate that a bomb, let's call it a gadget, shall we? That a 1 kilogram magnesium gadget should yield approximately 20,000 tons of TNT.
Well, how much damage will that do?
It depends on efficiency in the energy release, Bob. So our aim is to get as much energy...
Come on. How much damage?
Severe pathological effects within a radius of 1,000 yards. Wow. Now, we need to calculate cross-sections. Different configurations have different critical masses. We also need to learn more about magnesium and copper metallurgy. Science hasn't before asked you to think about explosives, but it will now.
Which lab for those experiments?
I'd suggest the outdoor one. Down in the valley. We also need to study radiation medicine. We don't know much about radiation effects on individual human beings, let alone groups.
Are we expected to volunteer for those experiments?
We've also got to figure out how to make it small enough to transport safely. Instead of Enrico's huge, slow pile, we need a small, fast gadget.
Yes, how much fission fuel exists today?
Thank you, Hans. About 1/1,000,000th of what we need. That establishes our deadline. We create the technology to produce the gadget while Site X enriches the magnesium and up north produces the copper. We should have enough magnesium in 24 months.
But how much is enough?
Enough for one gadget.
You think that's enough to end the war?
Well, we'll see. To conclude for now, the immediate program focuses on neutron properties and the ordnance problem. We also must determine critical size and time scale working with large but subcritical material. Now that we're all up to date, I plan weekly colloquiums to stay that way. We'll distribute the notes on this conference to new recruits when they arrive.
How many more are you expecting, Opie?
1,500. Now that includes families and support personnel.
What do we do while waiting for experimental results?
Well, start calculating and building on that basis. Theory alone, pure and not so simple. Thank you, gentlemen. See you tonight on Bathtub Row, 8 o'clock for Martinis with Kitty and me.
I believe your people actually want to make a bomb. What if we simply poison the German food supply with radioactive byproducts?
Why are you rushing off?
Another train.
North to Hanford.
East to Oak Ridge.
I respected Fermi enormously. He was one of the few physicists equally inspired as a theorist and experimentalist. What's the difference? Theoretical physicists know why and how a widget works. Experimental physicists make sure that it does. Now, most of what had to be done at Los Alamos had to be done for the first time, and with materials that were practically unavailable. Every day, I would study and read about all these things I didn't know very much about. The weekly colloquia felt like a grand final examination with a senior faculty of experts from around the world. Never before or since had physicists formed such a critical mass.
Darling, I could smell you coming down the hall.
Is it me or this?
Steak, just what I've been craving.
No, extravagance is too much for my putsy 84 cents for 2 pounds. Happy anniversary.
One and counting. This is for you.
Ooh, just what I always wanted. A chef's hat, apron, and gloves. How's the Presbyterian Sanitarium treating you? How do you feel?
Like an alien. Until I look out the window and tell myself all I've done is return to the primordial Jewish home, the desert. How's the physics sanitarium treating you?
Oh, guess how my driver's license identifies me.
Boy genius.
Nope.
Oh, renowned professor.
Guess again.
All-American heartthrob.
No, my name is number 185. I reside at Special List B. My signature is not required.
Sounds like science fiction.
No, science fact. We're non-entities. The place isn't marked on maps. We can't vote.
FDR needs yours.
Can't get divorced.
I like it here.
Can't adopt children.
And natural ones dope.
We can't even probate a will.
Great. As long as we don't leave, we're immortal.
And when the work stops, though it seldom does, there's nothing to do.
You could write me.
Oh, Arlene, you know I hate to write. But I have a new toy. It siphons off nervous energy.
You can't think of better ways?
I play outside and dance around a tree pretending I'm an Indian.
Your neighbors, they appreciate the music?
Oh, they do at the Dude Ranch. I'm moving to the dorm next week. Whoa, can I take some of this powder?
Of course.
And some hairpins?
Over there.
And one of your nightgowns?
How about the one I'm wearing?
Oh, I have a serious affliction, Putsy.
What's that?
Loving you forever. I was assigned to the men's dorm soon as it was finished. I chose a room across from the girls' dorm, but later discovered that a big tree blocked the view. Now, I didn't want a roommate, okay? So I opened the top bunk, messed up the sheets, then threw powder on the bathroom floor and laid out Arlene's nightgown. That night, my pajamas are folded neatly under my pillow. Hers are folded neatly under the pillow of the top bunk. I keep this up 4 nights until everybody's settled in and there's no more danger of a roommate being assigned. Scientists don't keep regular schedules. When you're consumed with a problem, you keep working on it day and night, both at home and at your office. Oh, yeah, the labs were finished. No ideas begin over coffee or an argument. When physicists get together, ideas hop back and forth, up and down, in and out. You start in one direction and end in another. It's like a chain reaction.
2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30.
Richard, listen. I have been thinking how we could make it more efficient, and I thought of the following idea. Look at this.
Hey, that's crazy, Hans. It's not going to work. It's got this damn flaw. You see, you're wrong.
I'm wrong? No, you're crazy. It would work if we tried it this way. Look here. Yeah.
No, that couldn't possibly work either. You're mad. But have you ever considered...
That is ridiculous. But it makes me wonder if this might maybe then...
No, it's more like this.
Okay, even so, it has got nothing to do with my original problem.
I got a little carried away, Hans. I'm always dumb that way. If the idea looks lousy, I say it looks lousy. But if it looks good, I say it looks good. Simple proposition. I forgot I was talking to the head of the entire theoretical division.
Yeah, I need to push ideas against someone, Dick. Someone to find flaws, eh? Ah, I want you to be a group leader.
I'm only 25.
Well, you'll be the youngest. Your group will calculate the gadget's energy release.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. So, the pressure squared to 48 is 2304.
Whoa, how did you do that?
What? You don't know how to square numbers near 50?
Nah.
Oh, boy. say your number is 47, which is 3 less than 50. Then the answer is about 300 less than 2,500, which is 50 squared. So that's 2,200. And to find out exactly how much is left over, you square what's residual. So for 47, it's 3 squared is 9. So 47 squared is 2,209. Huh? Got it?
You know arithmetic pretty well.
You have to notice the numbers, Richard.
Hans, mein Freund, wie geht's?
Oh, Enrico, sehr gut. Und du?
Gut.
Ja, und Laura?
Ja.
Don't you two feel a little odd speaking German? I mean, here, now?
Well, we speak German ever since Rome.
Rome?
I was the first foreigner to study physics at the university. You're just in time, Enrico. The calculations we are doing are very difficult. Dick here is our expert.
Oh, Professor Fermi, you know, I can usually tell what the answer's going to look like. When I get it, I can usually explain why. But this thing is so complicated, I can't. Let me describe the problem. Then maybe you could...
Wait. It's better. Before you tell me the result, let me think. It's going to come out like this.
Right.
Well, there's a perfectly obvious explanation.
You're doing my specialty, but doing it 10 times better.
What, you're surprised? Enrico, möchtest du essen?
Jawohl.
Hey, will you be staying long this visit?
A little consulting, then back to Chicago.
No, you should move here.
Maybe next year.
Oh, Laura would like the mountains. Hey, Enrico, did you hear...
And the town?
The town? But, have you heard this cowboy song? Yeah. Home.
I'm naming him associate director.
So he's going to stay?
I hope. I'm also creating a division, F division.
Oh, let me guess. F for Faust?
No.
Fission?
No, not Fusion or Feynman either. F for Fermi.
January 31st, 1944.
U.S. attacks Marshall Islands.
I hear it's a home for pregnant wacks.
Nope, they're doing submarine research, making windshield wipers for them.
To the editor, since I live on the highway, I am fully aware of the stream of trucks heavily loaded on their way up the Los Alamos Mesa, but empty on their way down. This is clearly yet another New Deal boondoggle wasting the taxpayers' money.
Don't be a blabberer, gentlemen. As we grow, so do rumors about our purpose. Keep your trap shut. Don't be a blabberer.
Let's spread word an electrical rocket is being developed.
Yeah, that'll explain all the electrical equipment shipped in.
And the loud noises.
Designated rumor mongers will visit local bars where they can inadvertently let slip some fabricated details.
You know, some folks actually bought the one about an electric rocket. I mean, security affected everything, where you could go and how often. We got used to it. We could only write to relatives and to friends who'd be alarmed by silence, and we got used to that. So did they. Soon after arriving, mail censorship began. I never got used to that. We agreed not to seal our letters, and the censor would close them if everything was okay, return them with a little note if it weren't.
The least you can do is send your family a letter regularly, even if you hate to write. Joan and your dad have devised a plan to entice you into corresponding. Count me in.
Mr. Feynman, what's this?
A letter from my father.
Yes, but what is this?
The dots around different words?
Yes.
That's a code.
We know that. What does it say?
I don't know. It's in code.
Mr. Feynman, do you know Regulation 4E?
Would that be the one just after 4D but before 4F?
Yes. Quote, codes, ciphers, or any other form of secret writing will not be used. Crosses, X's, or other markings of a similar nature are equally objectionable, unquote. Now, what's this letter?
Oh, that's for my wife.
And what's this?
What's what?
This.
TJXYWZTWIX3.
Yes.
That's a code, too.
What's the key to it?
I don't know. It's a game. My family writes me in codes they think I can't decipher.
They'll have to send the key inside their letters.
But I don't want to see the key.
We'll take it out of the letter before you get it.
I'll write my wife today. Dear Arlene, it's a long story, but if you could write me differently, the censor would be a lot happier.
Mr. Feynman, Regulation 8Z, quote, information concerning censorship, regulations, or discourse on the subject is prohibited, unquote.
You wanted her to write different letters.
You can't write her about censorship. It's against the law to censor civilian mail. You have to tell her in person.
Soon as I can.
Oh, send your boyfriend a letter on a jigsaw puzzle. We sell the blank, you write your letter, take the puzzle apart and mail it. Oh.
Mr. Feynman. We do not have time to play games.
I haven't seen her since we spoke last.
Your wife must confine herself to ordinary letters.
Dear Putzi, I was playing with one of the computing machines and noticed that if you divide 1 by 243, you get 0.004115226337. Rather cute, the way it repeats itself.
Paragraph 17b. Letters are only to be written in English, Russian, Spanish, Portuguese, German, and Latin. Permission to use any other language must be obtained in writing. No codes.
It's not code. If you divide 1 by 243, you do, in fact, get 0.004115226337. And there's no more information in that than there is in the number 243, which is hardly any information at all. So, may I please use Arabic numerals in my letters?
I'll look into it.
He never replied.
Yes, what is it, Mr. Feynman?
Look at this. Opened by U.S. Army Examiner. Darling, it's very difficult writing because I feel that the... No, I can't read this word because it's inked out. Is looking over my shoulder. You are not supposed to do this to incoming mail.
Don't be ridiculous. Censors don't work with ink eradicator. They cut things out with scissors.
Okay. Dear Putzi, did you use ink eradicator in your last letter? The administration says they use scissors instead.
No, I didn't use in my letter. It must have been the...
We had some fun. At Los Alamos, we live surrounded by a fence, obligated to wear security badges, forced to live with censorship all so we could save the world from totalitarianism. Ordnance testing, down in the valley. Hey, thanks for the report, Bob.
Huh?
Very interesting.
Hey, where'd you get that?
From your filing cabinet.
But it's locked.
We're storing secrets in file cabinets protected by tiny, no-good padlocks. We never had anything this flimsy at Princeton. They're Yale locks.
Well, lucky it was you who discovered the security lapse. We'll replace the locks with these. Only a million combinations. Lock up when you leave the lab, huh?
Sure thing. Night, Bob. One of my diseases is a compulsive need to solve puzzles. If there's a secret, I have to know what it is. Now, I discovered that you could be two numbers above or below the actual number, and the lock still opened. That left 8,000 combinations, okay? Now, my final discovery, now this took nearly 2 years of research, was that it's easy to take the last two numbers off the lock if it's open. So, I used to practice all the time, you know? Instead of playing in the regular poker games, I'd practice opening locks like a card shop practices cards. I got quicker and quicker, also more and more unobtrusive. I'd come in and talk to some guy, sort of lean against his file cabinet, and he wouldn't even notice I was doing anything. I wasn't doing anything, just playing with the dial, that's all, just playing with the dial. But all the time, I was taking the last two numbers off. Then I'd go back to my office and write them down. I kept this up till I'd covered everyone in the lab. I was real sociable for a month or so. Now, if you have the last two numbers, it only takes about 3 minutes to open a safe, okay? So, I got an excellent reputation for safe cracking.
Excuse me, Mr. Feynman? Colonel Schmaltz is out of town, and we really need a document from his safe. Could you get it for us?
Sure.
Dear Chairman Burge, Richard Feynman would make a superb addition to the Berkeley faculty after the war. He is by all odds the most brilliant young physicist here, and everyone knows this. He is a man of thoroughly engaging character and personality, extremely clear, extremely normal in all respects, and an excellent teacher with a warm feeling for physics in all its aspects.
Here's your file.
Thanks a heap.
You know, this is incredibly difficult.
You're wonderful.
Gosh. Well, if just anybody knew how to crack a safe, everything at Los Alamos would be very unsafe.
He is the most ingenious member of my team. I would sooner lose any two scientists than lose Richard Feynman. When I needed additional theorists for G Division, I assigned Dick to four different groups.
General Groves, you need to okay my report.
Yeah, I'll read it now.
You mind if I look at your safe?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's see. Yes, all right. This is fine. Let me put it away.
What, you think it's safe in there?
Of course.
That's because civilians call it a safe.
You think it's not safe?
Oh, a good safe cracker could open it in 30 minutes.
Can you open it in 30 minutes?
No, I said a good safe cracker. It would take me 45.
Yeah? I'm going to stay here and watch. You're not going to get it open, Dick.
I noticed a young man who was the only one unafraid of me and my reputation. He'd call new ideas mistaken if he thought they were. When I returned to Los Alamos, I sought Dick Feynman out. I knew he wouldn't be polite like the others. Oh, yes, Dr. Bohr. Of course, Professor Bohr. Oh, yes, oh, that's exactly right here, Dr. Professor Bohr. He called one of my new ideas crazy, the next one foolish. 2 hours later, I said, Dick, I think we can call in the big shots now.
You making any progress?
Hey, you either open it or you don't.
What the hell?
Look, when the door to the safe or the top drawer of the filing cabinet's open, it's easy to get the combination. You've got to insist that everybody keep their doors locked while they're working. When they're open, they're very vulnerable.
That's very interesting.
You get away from me, Feynman. Don't you take another step near me.
What happened?
I had to memorize a new combination because of you.
Chairman Burge. He is an extremely brilliant theorist and a man of the greatest robustness, responsibility, and warmth. A brilliant and lucid teacher. One of the most responsible men I have ever met. We regard him as invaluable. His work carries a weight far beyond his years. I simply do not understand the delay in securing his appointment. Have you encountered a Jewish quota at Berkeley? Not again.
July 11th, 1944. District Court, Chicago.
I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity.
Laura, mi piccione, mi bella. You like the mountains, desert too. No, really. Less humid than Chicago in summer, warmer in winter. You like it.
It's so isolated.
The population doubles every 9 months.
Nice round number.
They have a library, chamber music, square dances.
Yippee!
Mountain hiking, we can ski again.
Ah, just like the Italian Alps, eh?
The children can roam wherever they want. It's entirely surrounded by a fence.
From the madhouse of fascism to a concentration camp in the desert. And we're not even Japanese.
August 25th, 1944. Paris liberated.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, Your Eminence.
To the Pope.
The presence of friends makes me feel like home already.
Oh, it
does, Enrico. It really does. Martin View, so incredible. They cover a multitude of sins. Limitations, too, like no...
No paved streets.
No traffic jams, either.
No street names.
No...
In-laws?
Nuclear families only.
No...
Unemployed?
No idle rich.
No starving poor.
No homeless, either.
No...
Bathtubs.
Showers only.
Oh, the black holes of Calcutta.
These showers are safe.
Los Alamos is like year-round boys' camp.
I hear that we're breaking maternity records for a community this size.
One-fifth of the married women pregnant at any given time.
Half the hospital used as a nursery.
Rural free delivery.
No, $1 a day, the cost of the food for the mother.
All those birth certificates. Place of birth, P.O. Box 1663.
Sandoval County Road. Santa Fe, New Mexico. USA!
Is it true that Groves ordered that something be done about it?
Enforce separation?
Nah, the army is gonna pull out.
November 7, 1944.
German VP.
Dear Mr. President, secrecy has prevented adequate contact between scientists and those responsible for formulating policy. The very existence of these weapons will adversely affect the post-war position of the United States and make urban centers vulnerable to surprise attack. International control should be considered involving Great Britain and the Soviet Union. The greatest danger is the outbreak of a preventive war.
Dearest Putzi, it just snowed up here, but it's not as cold or depressing or ugly as New York. Clouds roll in across the valley and dissect the mountains. It stirs in me some kind of irrational response. Geez, maybe I'm getting an aesthetic sense or conscience. Hey, don't report me to any scientists. I'm still loving you. Oh, P.S. Three women gave me a ride home Sunday night. They were kind of ugly, so I remained faithful without even having the fun of exerting willpower to do it.
Dearest coach, my new stationery just arrived, so I'm trying it out. Hope you like it, because I ordered a duplicate set for you. No, it is not engraved Mrs. Richard P. Feynman. I thought you'd prefer Mr. Arlene Greenbaum.
Dear dope, my handwriting isn't as pretty as yours. Not my hands, hair, or face either. But now my stationery is. You're silly and cute and lots of fun.
Darling, the blank sheet enclosed is not written in invisible ink, nor is it a code. Mail it back with a fresh sheet of your stationery. I'm dying to see what friction between the sheets creates. Call it an experiment in spontaneous combustion, or the yearning of separated spouses. Come soon. Your Putzi always. Oh, P.S. I feel like a millionaire. Macy sent a refund for 44 cents. I owe you 22.
Don't worry about money. I know math. Room and oxygen, about $200 a month. Nurses, another $300. My salary is $380 a month, and it costs very little to live and eat here. My savings combined with your $3,300, the piano, and the ring will cover the shortfall over the short period until you're better. But you gotta drink your milk and get your weight back over 100 pounds. Don't worry about my social life either. I like to dance at the parties and flirt with the nurses, but nothing more. I love you only. Oh, P.S. My chest x-ray's clear.
Sorry, I'm so moody. I'm drinking so much milk I've grown horns and started chewing cud. Udders are in the usual place. Darling, I think the restlessness I feel is due to pent-up emotions. I really think we'd both feel happier if we released our desires. Come soon. Dance with me.
You are a beautiful woman. Your strength rises and falls like the flow of a mountain stream. I'm a reservoir for your strength. Without you, I would be empty and weak. See you Friday evening. What's it?
Oh, our song, Coach. I've reserved a special place for you on my card. Lie down. No, next to me.
really, Putzi?
Really, it's okay. I want to. I need to.
Dear Professor Szilard, thank you for the copy of your memorandum to the president. I would be happy to discuss these matters with you in my Manhattan apartment on May 8th. Sincerely, Eleanor Roosevelt.
April 12th, 1945. FDR dies.
Well, President Truman, may I have your ear for a moment, sir?
Huh?
Shh, they're talking about
this.
Huh? He said he's going to come over here.
Hey! It does what?
My friends, I would like to propose a toast to the Allied victory. I have been waiting for over a decade for this, worrying the whole time that the Nazis could not be defeated. You know, until the little man stripped me of my post, I never thought of myself as a Jew. I was one of the first out of the university door in 33. 100 physicists more wandered with me in exile. Many landed here. We were handed a moral purpose for our lives. And now, we need a new one.
We have to finish the job, Hans.
Oh, we got there first. The enemy has been vanquished.
One enemy.
The enemy.
The Japanese have more tenacity.
They also have Yoshio Nishina, too.
Gentlemen, per favore, let's be gentlemen. Have you forgotten our little surprise? Happy birthday, Richard.
Happy birthday. Those drumsticks are from everyone, Bongo Boy.
Hey, they're made of rubber.
Happy 27, Coach. Please come soon to celebrate our anniversary.
Two. And counting.
We'll know soon if I'm pregnant.
Hey, you just take care of yourself.
How about Donald for a boy, Matilda for a girl.
Sit down, Arthur. We were motivated because we feared the Germans. Now it's not clear what we're working for.
President Truman will decide, Leo.
He knows less than we do.
That's why a panel has been appointed to hear the concerns of scientists.
Now, who's on it?
Lawrence, Fermi, Oppenheimer.
Me. You know what I think.
What? Yes, I do know what you think, but Los Alamos may not.
I'll go down there and I'll tell them myself.
Leo, you know as well as I that Groves won't let you set foot anywhere in the entire state. I will take MetLab recommendations with me when the panel meets down there June 16th. That gives you 10 days.
Frank will help. The other boys are confused what a moral issue is.
My wife. I'm always too slow. I understand at last how sick you were. It's a time to comfort you as you wish to be comforted, not as I think you should wish to be comforted. This time will pass. You will get better. You don't believe it, but I do. I adore a great and patient woman. Forgive me for my slowness to understand. I am your husband. I love you. Arlene and I had a hell of a good time together.
Dick, you need a vacation. Go back to Far Rockaway. We'll get in touch when we need to.
I must have done something to myself psychologically. I didn't cry until about a month later when I was walking past a department store and I noticed a pretty dress. I thought, Arlene would like that. And then it hit me.
Arthur, the panel should pay special attention to the sections I marked.
These considerations make an unannounced attack against Japan inadvisable. If the United States were the first to release this destruction upon mankind, she would sacrifice public support throughout the world, precipitate the race for armaments, and prejudice the possibility of reaching an international agreement on the future control of such weapons.
More favorable conditions could be created if nuclear bombs were first revealed to the world by a demonstration before representatives of the United Nations.
We urge that use of nuclear bombs be considered a problem of long-range national policy rather than military expediency, and that this policy be directed to international control of the means of nuclear warfare.
We're sending a copy of this report to the Secretary of War, Stimson.
And I will take a copy with me to Los Alamos.
Another crusade. Science has never been Leo's life.
He's always had as much passion for politics as science.
And sometimes more.
A United Nations demonstration on an uninhabited island might save lives.
And if it fizzled?
Even if it didn't, we'd lose the advantage of surprise.
When will Oak Ridge have enough magnesium for a gadget?
Next month.
Wasting it all on a demonstration makes zero sense.
Leo's not a team player.
He's wasting time thinking about the future.
Wasting?
Chicago finished its assignment months ago. They don't live in the present anymore.
And here?
Complete absorption in immediate tasks.
There's no time for speculation.
The gadget will save lives.
How?
By preventing an invasion that will cost tens of thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Japanese.
Leo thinks we're responsible for opening the door to an era of destruction.
Some of us feel responsible for opening the doors of science. No one can stop its progress. If there's fault to be found, it lies with those who want war, not those who want knowledge. This is what I think of that. That's my frank opinion.
Here's my recommendation. We can propose no technical demonstration likely to bring an end to the war. We see no acceptable alternative to direct military use. J. Robert Oppenheimer. Enrico, will you sign?
Of course.
Arthur. Arthur.
July 15,
1945. Why name the test Trinity, Robert?
A holy experiment that reveals a mystery? What?
Death followed by resurrection?
Something like that.
Should we invite a chaplain to attend?
Yeah. How about rabbit's feet and four-leaf clovers?
Everyone should relax. Teller says the chance of igniting the atmosphere is 1 in 3 million.
Oh, Edward's calculations always put me at ease.
Hey, what's that area over there?
Homara do Muerto.
Meaning what?
A journey of the dead.
I see.
The wind and rain could lift the debris, shower the region with radioactive dust. Homara del Muerto indeed. Maybe we should postpone.
The weather has to change.
What if the gadget doesn't go off?
Bainbridge climbs the tower to check it himself.
Another PhD serving science. Let's guess the size of the explosion.
What?
We'll have a betting pool. Oh. Robert will collect your dollar, any number between 100 and 20,000 in equivalent tons of TNT. Gentlemen, place your bets.
All right, 8,000.
I say 1,400.
300.
45,000.
It's only supposed to go up to 20,000, Edward.
I'm an optimist.
Yeah, well, I'm not. Zero.
Such confidence in your colleagues, Norman.
200.
Isadora?
18,000.
Where's Dick?
I sent a telegram. The baby is expected.
Get his bet when he arrives. I'll announce the winner soon afterwards.
Let's hope.
Governor Dempsey, General Groves here. Sorry to wake you up in the middle of the night, sir. No, I can't say where I am, but I thought you should know you might have to declare martial law later today. No, I can't say why. I wanted you to be prepared, just in case. That's right, martial law. Governor, you can go back to sleep now.
At a long siren, 2 minutes to zero, all personnel whose duties do not require otherwise will lie prone, heads away from ground zero. Face and eyes are to be directed toward the ground.
Yeah, be on the alert for snakes, too.
Remember, injury by ultraviolet light is best avoided by wearing long trousers and shirts with long sleeves. At zero, do not watch the flash directly. Turn over after it has occurred and watch the cloud.
She's pretty confident there's going to be a flash.
Stay on the ground until the blast wave has passed. Add two short blasts indicating the passing of hazard from light and blast. All personnel will prepare to leave.
9, 8, 7,
assuming the chain reaction stops.
5, 4, 3.
I'm determined to look the devil in the eye.
Last millisecond of Earth's existence, the last man will see what we have just seen.
Bright as the light to be seen at the end of the world, and at the beginning too. Lights that preceded the word, that preceded the God that now seems dead.
I no longer consider the Pentagon safe.
A very intense flash of light and a sensation of heat on my parts of the body that were exposed. The countryside became brighter than in full daylight.
Like opening the heavy curtains of a darkened room to a flood of sunlight.
Who would have thought that it would be so beautiful? Like a halo in a medieval painting of Christ's ascension.
Faust sold his soul to the devil.
Prospero ignored affairs of state for his love of books and magic.
Prometheus condemned to perpetual torture for giving the fire of the gods to humanity.
Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
A petition to the president. We, the 67 undersigned scientists, believe that if rival powers are permitted uncontrolled possession of these new means of destruction, the cities of the United States and of other nations will be in continuous danger of sudden annihilation. All resources of the United States, moral and material, may have
to
be mobilized.
Hey, Dick, crazier than victory on homecoming weekend, huh?
Better than Princeton beating Columbia, right, Dick?
I hear the Hanford football team's adopting a new nickname, Atomic Bombers.
Enrico, I understand the gadget worked, but what exactly is a gadget?
I can't say yet. We did it, only 28 months after the lab opened. We did it first.
I'm so proud of my husband, whatever it is that he's done.
What are you moping about, Bob?
It's a terrible thing we made.
But you started it. You got me into it. And right now, you're the only one thinking about it. But 2 months later...
Colleagues. Friends. I now conclude my days as director of Los Alamos. I believe that if atomic bombs are to be added as new weapons to the arsenals of a warring world, or to the arsenals of nations preparing for war, then the time will come when mankind will curse the names of Los Alamos and of Hiroshima. The people of this world must unite, or they will perish.
Trinity, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki depleted our entire supply of gadgets. But by 1946, we'd begun to store nuclear weapons. Our stockpile totaled 9. Years later, we tried to remember if there'd ever been any talk about the social implications of the bomb. Priscilla Duffield, Oppenheimer's secretary, put it succinctly.
I would have known if any such discussions had occurred. I'm sure there were none.
The attitude of Americans toward scientists used to be a curious mixture of exaggerated admiration and amused contempt. Never again was it quite so amused. Monday morning quarterback is the easiest position on the team to play, okay? When you're doing science, you enter a different world. You are using what you know to imagine what you don't know. You look at possibilities and filter some of them out, the wrong ones, the ugly ones, but not at first, and this is very interesting, the impossible ones. Bohr liked to ask, is it crazy enough to be right? Solving a problem is a beautiful experience. The harder the problem, the greater the beauty. Like all beauty, it gives pleasure. Original theory is absolutely beautiful because it's absolutely pure, unsullied by experimental proofs. Only as finite as your imagination's ability to grasp a possibility of possibilities, a wonder of wonders. Upon solving a scientific problem, you walk when no one has walked before you. In the ether of pure science, for finite moments, unexpected and exquisitely profound, a scientist can discover truth. We were children, okay? Then students, grad students, teaching assistants, fellows, docs, postdocs, full-fledged scientists, but not necessarily adults. Rabi thought of physicists as Peter Pans of the human race. They never grow up. They always keep their curiosity. When I was younger, I thought science would make good things for everybody. I mean, it was obviously useful. It was good. Working on the atomic bomb was a very serious matter. It represented the destruction of people. We started for a good reason. Then we were working very hard to accomplish something, and you stop thinking, you know. You just stop. After the war, I worried about the bomb. I didn't know what the future was going to look like, and I certainly wasn't sure we would last until now. Therefore, one question was, is there some evil involved in science? Now, put another way, what's the value of the science I had dedicated myself to, the thing I loved, when I saw what terrible things it could do? It was a question I had to answer. Atomic bombers and their bomb. Our bomb. My bomb. Ended the war. Peace came to the world around me. And to the world within me. Head. Heart. Conscience. Consciousness. Yes. And no. Is Mr. Feynman joking? I wish I were.
You've been listening to Atomic Bombers by Russell Vandenbroek. The cast in alphabetical order was Larry Cox as J. Robert Oppenheimer, Jeannie Elias as Laura Fairman, Robin Gammel as Leo Szilard, John Matthews as Richard Feynman, Philip Mershon as the Monitors and Other Men's Voices, Danny Mora as Enrico Fermi, Wolf Muser as Hans Bethe, Lisa Jane Persky as Arlene Feynman, Judy Shear as the WAC Secretary and Women's Voices, Tom Virtue as Robert Wilson, and Ron West as Arthur Compton. Stage manager and live sound effects, Amy Strong. Radio production by Raymond Guarna. Atomic Bombers was directed by Valerie Landsberg. I'm Susan Lowenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works, and you're listening to The Play's the Thing. Joining me now is Dr. Robert Christie, a leading theoretical physicist and astrophysicist and university professor emeritus at Caltech, where he's taught since 1946. Dr. Christie is uniquely qualified to talk about the Manhattan Project, since he was involved from its earliest stages. After gaining his Ph.D. at Berkeley under the tutelage of J. Robert Oppenheimer, he joined Enrico Fermi's group at the Metallurgical Laboratory of the University of Chicago. Here he worked on the first atomic pile and was witness to the first nuclear chain reaction. Then he joined the theoretical division under Hans Bethe at Los Alamos. His work focused on the plutonium implosion device, which came to be known as the Christie gadget. This was the more complex triggering mechanism that was tested at Alamogordo on July 16, 1945, the Trinity test. Since that time, Dr. Christie has done important work in nuclear and particle physics, as well as astrophysics, for which he received the prestigious Eddington Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society. He's also been a member of the National Research Council's Committee on Dosimetry, investigating the radiation effects at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Welcome, Dr. Christie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
How did you become interested in science, and what led you into physics?
At a very early age, I was interested in the natural phenomena around me. And an early experience was to comment in a physics class that I had been surprised by the appearance of my big toe sticking out of the water in the bathtub. and everyone laughed, which I understand, but it had to do with the refraction of the light by the water. And the physics teacher in high school explained that to me.
Well, how did you come to be a PhD student in quantum mechanics at Berkeley with Robert Oppenheimer as your professor?
I studied at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And this was Depression years, so that my object was to stay in school as long as I could since I couldn't get a job if I left school. In the class ahead of me, there was a friend of mine named George Volkoff, who was also interested in the same things I was interested in, namely theoretical physics. And the principal source of all the work was going on, the largest group and the most active group was in Berkeley under Robert Oppenheimer. So that he applied the year ahead of me and was accepted in Berkeley. And I guess they liked him because when I applied there, they also accepted me and granted me a fellowship.
Well, by all accounts, Oppenheimer was an extraordinary teacher. What were the special qualities that set him apart, and what did he give you as a student that other teachers didn't?
Mostly, he inspired me. That is, he inspired his students. He made it very attractive to try to learn physics. He did not make it easy. It was very difficult to follow his courses. Oppenheimer was always raising the level of his teaching because he didn't want the students to be bored. You wanted to do as well as you could in order to please him.
How did his strengths as a teacher relate to his abilities at leading the Manhattan Project?
Some of the same things. Inspiration, that is, people who liked to work with him, they trusted him, that he understood things, he had a complete grasp of the subject, and that they explained something to him, he would understand it immediately and try to work it into what the general plans were.
When did you become aware of the real possibility of developing a nuclear weapon?
Nuclear weapons were still, to me, a somewhat distant idea. When I was invited to go to Los Alamos in the spring of 1943 to work with Oppenheimer there when they were starting up Los Alamos. And previously, summer of 1942, Oppenheimer had gathered a half a dozen leading theoretical experts in Berkeley. That included Bethe and Teller and a number of others, including Bob Serber, his assistant. And they had been working on the theory of what made a nuclear bomb explode, how much energy would be released in a nuclear explosion. And they'd solved that pretty well. They had a pretty good idea what was going to happen, theoretically. And then they started working about the so-called super, namely, could you set off a chain reaction in deuterium? Deuterium and deuterium making helium-4, because that could be much more powerful because you could have an endless amount of that. In the atomic bomb, you're limited by, you can't bring together much more than what is a little bit overcritical because you have to have the thing to start with. It can't be overcritical when you start.
This is the path that Edward Teller was on.
Yes,
is that not correct?
Yeah. That's correct. Edward Teller was fascinated by the super, starting already in the year before when they worked in Berkeley. And so his whole focus really was, how do you make a super? And he retained that focus when he went to Los Alamos. He was much more interested in the super than in the atomic bomb, whereas Oppenheimer recognized that whatever you thought about the super, you had to make an atomic bomb first to be a trigger for it. So that he focused his entire attention at Los Alamos on atomic bombs.
Was the relationship between Oppenheimer and Teller already at Los Alamos at that early stage somewhat uncomfortable or
adversarial? I think it was a little strained. I think it was strained because Edward was a very emotional person. They really didn't see eye to eye. And finally, I think Edward was allowed to pursue his own interests with a few people to help him quite separately from the main work on the atomic bomb. He did not participate in the work on the bomb at all.
In your minds at the time, did you and your colleagues compartmentalize between the different potential applications of the work you were doing, or was it more of an abstraction? In other words, the science itself, was that the focus?
No, the focus was on making a bomb that worked. Everything was aimed at that. Every possible problem in making and delivering a bomb was analyzed and worked on, both from the how to make a gun that could bring two pieces together, as in the Hiroshima bomb, and which was used with U-235. And it was soon found up there at Los Alamos that plutonium had a property which made it basically almost impossible to use with the gun bomb, because the gun assembly was too slow and the reaction would set itself off before the pieces would be very supercritical and you get a small explosion. So the focus immediately became on, could you find a faster way to bring the pieces of plutonium together in order to make it go off with a higher explosivity? If you took a thin shell of plutonium and could place explosive around it and set it all off at once and drive that shell inward, it would go inward so fast that when it reached the center, it would have a much higher than normal density. The metal would be compressed to several times its normal density. And this meant that you could make a explosion out of a much less than a normal critical mass. The critical mass decreases the higher the density. And so if you get more dense material, the mass needed to make it explode is smaller. So the idea was you could get a very high explosion. You'd bring the material together very rapidly with a very, very much over the critical mass and be a tremendous success. And the only problem was, could you bring this material together symmetrically so that it was not all crumpled up when it got to the center, but rather as a nice, smooth implosion? And this was a tremendous worry. I was assigned at that time as a person to calculate the results of the experiments and interpret them. I finally realized that the implosion of a rather thicker shell could result in a good explosion because the material at the center hits itself and gets compressed before the shock wave that reflects from the center out again gets to the outside. And after thinking about that, I realized you didn't have to have a hole in the center at all, that you could have a solid sphere. And if you could implode that by putting explosive on the outside, that then you would get enough of a compression effect at the center when the implosion wave or explosion wave hit the center, that you would get a reasonable nuclear explosion. This was the route that I followed in trying to devise the implosion bomb that was tested at Alamogordo and exploded at Nagasaki.
Tell us about the Trinity test, which almost didn't happen because of bad weather. Did anything surprise you? And what made the strongest impression?
Most of us really didn't know what to expect. And so we were waiting there in the dark, stormy weather. And finally the word came through that they were going to go ahead with the test. I was in a group of observers about 20 miles away. I was not one of those that was in bunkers close by. We were out in the open, and we were given the kind of glass that is in a welder's helmet to protect his eyes from the intense light of an arc. We were given these to hold up in front of our eyes. And so when the time came and the countdown was going on, we held these up in front of our eyes and looked in the general direction of where the tower was, where the bomb would go off. The bomb went off with this fantastically brilliant flash of light, which lightened up the whole desert all around. What we could see of the bomb was it rapidly became a glowing sphere of gas, which, as it finally got bigger, began to cool and mix in with air. And finally, as it mixed in with air, you could see on the outside a faint purple glow, which one could recognize as the effects of radioactivity due to the fission products in the bomb, the radiations interacting with the air and exciting the air. It was an eerie thing as it rose in the air, this swirling mass of hot gas, and with the bluish glow around it. It rose in the air and finally disappeared. It was absolutely awe-inspiring and amazing.
I'd like to go back to Oppenheimer and Edward Teller. First, Oppenheimer, what is your sense of him after the war, and what was he trying to achieve?
His main focus was to find a way of controlling nuclear developments internationally to prevent the whole world being armed with nuclear weapons. During visits to Los Alamos during the war, he and Bohr and some others had had lengthy discussions on this subject, trying to see if they could find a way. And finally, this culminated in a program that Oppenheimer put forward and was later brought to the United Nations, I think, as the Baruch Report, and which essentially embodied the work that Oppenheimer had been working on. This program was never supported basically by the United States government, and Truman expressed it by saying that they had a weapon that no one else had, and it gave them an advantage internationally, and they were going to use it to get whatever advantage they had. The essence of the Baruch proposal, which Oppenheimer put forward, was to share knowledge through a special United Nations commission of nuclear weapons with all countries who wished to take part in a program to control and essentially prevent the use of atomic weapons.
Was this activity on his part the beginning of the end for him with regard to the kinds of suspicions that some people in the government harbored that he was perhaps a communist sympathizer?
I do know that some portions of the government had been suspicious of him all along and had been very much against having him play a prominent role that he was chosen for at Los Alamos. I do know that during the Korean War, there was a program that he was involved, I think, in instigating, and I was involved in the program. It was a study program to see whether atomic weapons could be helpful in stopping a possible Russian invasion of Europe. And so in that study, we felt that it was indeed perhaps possible that atomic weapons of small size could be used on the battlefield. The plan of that program was anathema to the Strategic Air Command under General LeMay. They felt that the atomic weapons should be reserved entirely. We did not have many at the time, maybe 100, but they felt it should be entirely reserved for their use in strategic bombing of cities, the way it had been used in Japan. And to use up this precious material on the battlefield, he felt was a terrible thing. In addition, it would destroy the unique power that his command had. So that the entire report was suppressed by the Air Force. They wouldn't allow it to be circulated.
So later on, when the scientific community shunned Teller because he made a decision to testify against Oppenheimer in the hearings that were held to assess him as a security risk, where were you in all that? What were your feelings about him at the time?
Well, I've been a supporter of Oppenheimer, and you might say a disciple of his, ever since I was a graduate student at Berkeley. So that I was very much upset by the hearings, which I felt were an attempt to destroy a very great man who had been, was being very helpful in the government in proposing new thoughts. That is, this Baruch proposal was put forward by him. It was turned down, but that wasn't his fault. And he kept on pushing things that he felt would be humanitarian approaches to this terrible new energy that we had found. And so I and many others who felt similarly were strong supporters of Oppenheimer and very upset at the hearings entirely. And in fact, rather upset with those members of our scientific community who chose to testify against him. In particular, I felt so about Edward Teller, who was, you might say, a member of the same fraternity as Oppenheimer, namely theoretical physics. and that he did not, in so many words, testify against Oppenheimer, but you might say he damned him with faint praise. It was obvious what his intention was. It was to express his own fear of Oppenheimer as a possible communist agent.
Did you ever resume any kind of relationship with Teller in later years?
Not really. My break with Teller came shortly after the hearings, when I was at Los Alamos for a brief visit, and Teller was there too. We met accidentally on the porch of Fuller Lodge after lunch, and Teller approached me with his hand out to shake my hand, and I passed him by and ignored him. That was a very public break as far as I was concerned. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing, and you can't defend things that you do on the spur of the moment. You just do them.
Hmm. Well, you obviously felt very strongly. What are the lessons that you took away and we can take away from the Manhattan Project?
Well, I took away a great many lessons because I was young and impressionable. One of the lessons I took away is that when you get a country working together, both from the construction point of view and the scientific point of view, you can accomplish a fantastic amount in a short time. And I have never ceased to be amazed at what General Groves managed to do in putting together the Manhattan Project and making it work in such a short time. I've also learned that you can make bombs that are fantastically more powerful than those we made at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We've learned how to make them much smaller and much more powerful by thousands of times. So that what we could destroy then was a city. Now you can destroy the world. And that has impressed me that we're not spending nearly the effort that we need to spend in how to control this form of energy that we've unleashed.
Thank you. It was a wonderful conversation, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about a subject that is dear to my heart.
I've been talking to Dr. Robert Christie, a leading theoretical physicist and astrophysicist and university professor emeritus at Caltech. He also played a central role in the Manhattan Project. I'm Susan Lowenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works, and you're listening to a special presentation of the plays The Thing, part of the Relativity series, a monthly broadcast of science-themed plays, funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology. You can download this program from the KPCC website for 3 months, beginning June 9th. Go to kpcc.org and click on Podcasts. Join us next week for the Paris Letter, from the pen of one of our top writers for stage and television, John Robin Bates. Financial wizard Sandy Sonnenberg finds his personal and professional life threatened by unraveling secrets from his past. A tragic game of financial and moral betrayal plays out over 4 decades, with an exacting price for family and friends, love and marriage. John Glover, Ron Rifkin, Neil Patrick Harris, Josh Radner, and Patricia Wettig star in The Paris Letter. Next time on The Plays the Thing. I'm Susan Lowenberg. Thanks for joining us.
This is a production of LA Theater Works. Major support for the production of plays in our current live performance season is provided by the Peter Glanville Foundation. Additional support for LA Theater Works productions and programs is provided by the Capital Group Company's Charitable Foundation and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors through the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. To purchase a copy of this production or to receive a catalog of LA Theater Works plays, musicals, and novels, please call 1-800-708-8863 within the U.S. or visit our website, latw.org. Email your comments or suggestions to latw@latw.org. The Beverly Hilton Hotel is the official hotel of The Plays the Thing. Brendan Fox is the associate producer. Susan Albert Lowenberg is the executive producer. Recording, editing, and mixing engineer Dennis Contreras at VoiceBox Studios. The Plays the Thing radio series is produced by Mark Ward.